Well, we will go ahead and get started. My name is Amber Duke, and I'm interviewing Miss Gracie Lewis on Friday, July 15th, 2011 at the Carl Braden Memorial Center. So thank you so much for being able to join me this afternoon. Can you, for the record, say and spell your name for me?
My name is Gracie Lewis, and that's G-R-A-C-I-E-M, like in Mary is the middle initial. And my last name is Lewis, L-E-W-I-S.
Okay, can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born March 8, 1948 in Brownsville, Tennessee.
And how did you end up here in Louisville?
Well, my parents they just moved to Louisville. I don't know the reasons why, of course. I don't know the reasons why. But that's how my mother and father moved here. But I don't know the reason why they moved here. But I spent, the majority. I think then when they left Brownsville, I must have been 4 or 5 years old, probably around 4, because I was, living there. In fact, I have no memories of Brownsville, Tennessee at all. In fact, I've never gone there.
Oh, wow.
I was just born there.
Right, so you just remember your childhood
is
here.
All of my childhood was basically spent here in Louisville.
Okay. Well, can you talk about your educational background a little bit?
Yes, I have. My name is, like I said, I graduated from the University of the District of Columbia in August 1977. I was elected who's who among students in American universities and colleges.
What did you study there?
Urban studies, social welfare, with an emphasis on social welfare.
And tell me a little bit about what you've done professionally.
What I've done professionally is that I've worked for the federal government for 15 years at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And while I was there, I went basically from a shop steward to the vice president of my local. That's the American Federation of Government Employees. And I also, in terms of my working, I worked at that particular time, and I worked at Health and Human Services. I worked as a special assistant to Dr. George Boothelet, and he was over the department dealing with developmental disabilities. But that was not my first job. My first job there, which I'm proud of, is that in 1968, as you know, that when Dr. King had planned the March on Washington for Jobs, Peace, and Freedom, I can say definitely that I was a direct recipient of that particular dream. Because when he was killed on April the 4th, 1968, he had decided then that he was going to do this march. And that was because there was immense poverty in the country. And even though we had gained our civil rights, we really had not gotten our rights, number one, to a decent job. And it was a real big issue, just like we are confronted with now in terms of jobs. But there it was more or less racism that really kept us out of the situation, out of being able to gain gainful employment. So when he initiated that march and when he was killed, Coretta Scott King just picked up the torch, and then she went on. And believe me, she it ended up being 200,000 people that went to Washington for Jobs, Peace, and Freedom. So as a result of that, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, he developed the Great Society programs. And that's when a lot of our programs that you see, like community block programs and most of our programs were set up, social programs anyway. That's when they were set up as a direct result. So the president's commission did was they assigned, as they were setting these programs up, they needed support staff at that time. That was secretaries, clerks, stenographers, and everybody. Because once you set up a program, you got to have somebody answer the phone, you got to have somebody take notes and whatever. And so they went around the country with, they had a nationwide search for secretaries, clerks, stenographers, secretaries, and so on, just to be able to fill these vacancies. And so at that time, I was in business school. When I was a student at Aaron Strait High School, my major was business education. So I was in business school at that time, and they came over, and they was telling people about these new programs that were being developed, and they had a massive need for secretaries and clerk stenographers. And so since I was already in the business education field, I mean, I jumped right on it because I'd always wanted to live in Washington. So I took my typing shorthand test and everything, and then I took the written portion of my test at the federal building, which is still located at 6 and Broadway. And then they called me probably like in June, probably around June. And then I was selected to go to Washington. So in September 1969, I went to Washington, and I was I was a clerk stenographer. I got the job as a clerk stenographer, and I was working for Captain Van Osdall, OSDOL, and that was with the Military Sealift Command. That was right up under the Department of Navy. And so it was really an interesting experience because there I not only got a chance to use all of my skills there, because at that time, you know, everything was just opening up. There was a chicken definitely in every pot. I love it during that era because it literally was. I mean, it was the opening for the, also really the beginning, the very beginnings of the middle class, the black middle class then. Because at that particular point, you know, anybody who was in college, they was able to go into and get jobs, you know, being the directors of these newfound programs. Mm-hmm. And like your upward bound programs, all these type of programs was a direct result of Dr. King's march on, Dr. King, basically it was Dr. King's idea, the March on Washington. And they literally camped out, right outside the White House, right on the Washington Monument. And that was one of the reasons why Lyndon Johnson said, listen, I'm going to send these people back, because they were actually having clotheslines and everything just on the monument. And it was they saw poverty up close, mm-hmm. and personal. And that was such a momentous time. You know, I would never ever forget it, really, because I can truly say that I'm a direct recipient of his dream at that particular point. And then from there, after I worked with the Department of Health and Human Services, I then went to work as staff assistant. I went September of 1981, I went to work for Capitol Hill. I worked for the Subcommittee on Labor Standards, and that was up under the Committee on Education and Labor. And basically what I did was set up legislative hearings. I mean, that was basically what my job entailed. And to do that job, it required you to be, first of all, you definitely had to have a degree. You had to have an in-depth knowledge of the legislative process, the budget process, because that's what we did. And so with the labor standards, we dealt with longshoremen. We dealt with dealing with Social Security, occupational disease, and safety issues there. Also, we worked with practically all of the unions you could think of that it would have basically labor standards. You know, all of these places that hard workers, they have got to have standards that are obeyed. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's a matter really of developing legislation that would protect the workers on site. You know, even in terms of coal miners here in Kentucky, you know, we would actually, number one, be responsible for developing legislation that would protect the workers in the coal mines of Kentucky. And so it was a job that required you to be really stay up on top of what's going on. So it was like every day my day was to get up and start to read the papers, the Washington Post, the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and the Wall Street Journal. So I was really well read, and I really thought I had it going on really at that point. And really, if I had to, and I think that was really an opening for me, because in terms of now that I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, I mean, I know Capitol Hill. So if there's any issue that I'm concerned in, I'll know what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can issue a call to action because I know what happens on Capitol Hill. So it was a very good experience for me. But I do want to make a backup. When I first went to Washington, one other major issue that hooked me up with Ann Brayton was that in 1970, when there was a call, when the FBI was tracking down Angela Davis, that was when I got involved politically, when I got politically involved. At that time, in 1970, when I heard that this woman was captured and she was on the run from the FBI, I was working for the federal government. And at that time, it was like we always had a scare of communism. So what they did was they really did believe that Angela Davis was not just working to try to rescue those prisoners, because you know this was all about the what happened out in California. There was an uprising, and then a judge was killed along with several other inmates. And we got involved. So in Washington and all around the country, it was like the moment. It was like when Rosa Parks sat down, a movement began. Well, actually, there was a movement that was really begun around the Free Angela Davis case. And there was committees all over. So I was with the D.C. committee to Free Angela Davis. And then after she was freed in 1972, we all merged. I would say 1973, we all came together in Chicago and formed the National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. And that's when I met, I had an opportunity, privilege really, of meeting Ann Brayton.
Met her in Chicago with them.
Met her in Chicago, and it was one other person who was very instrumental, and I can't think of her name because she ended up really being Charlene Mitchell, so... She was the person that was really sort of the coordinator of the Eastern. She was the Eastern Regional Coordinator committed to Free Angela Davis and George Murphy. But it was a very, very interesting movement because she, when she was acquitted on June 7, 1972, we all met together in New York at Madison Square Garden, and we had this huge, she had a huge thank you concert because there was really millions of people that came to her defense. Even Aretha Franklin, when she was, even Aretha Franklin wanted to go her bond, but the state did not allow her to be released because they felt that she would flee the country at that time. This is just the momentum how everybody seemed to get involved, and including Aretha Franklin. So what she wanted to do, Angela was so grateful. Actually, she sort of said that today, the reason why that she was able to gain her freedom because of the national movement to Free Angela Davis came about. And that to me was the beginning of my political activism was around her. And it even created a problem on my job because I was working for the federal government, and of course then you have to take an oath of office to defend and protect the United States from all enemies. So they feel like anybody who would support Angela Davis, and she was a known communist, she never ever kept it in the closet. She was always out there out front saying, yeah, I'm a black woman communist. She would say it in that because she knew her roots. You know, she was brought up in Alabama, you know, during this whole time, and her mother and father were both activists and worked very closely with Dr. Martin Luther King. So she always said, I'm a black woman communist. She would say it like that. And I told them when I was called up on the carpet, and I was called up on the carpet, to ask me about why, you know, because I had this big poster of her on my office wall.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and I just didn't even really envision thinking about her being a communist. I was just saying it's freedom or whatever. And I just thought that I could just do this. And I couldn't, you know, naturally I work for the federal government. So that really was, that was really something, because when I was called up on the carpet about it, I just said, well, I was just more or less interested in her receiving a fair and impartial trial. I don't know nothing about communism. So I wasn't supporting communism. I was, and I've always been a person that believe in fair and impartiality when it comes to the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so now I know about how you got involved with the National Alliance. How did you then learn about the Kentucky Alliance and
okay,
get involved
in the
Okay, well,
now how I learned about the Kentucky Alliance was that, well, first of all, the when I first came back home to Louisville, Kentucky, because I lived in Washington for 20 years. Like I said, I left in 1969, and I did not return back to Louisville, Kentucky until 1989. It was probably around September of 1989 that I came back. And while I was here, Dr. Gwendolyn Patton, who was a very, very close friend of Ann Brayton and also a longtime civil rights activist. I mean, she was one of the persons that walked with, she knew Rosa Parks, she knew Dr. Kingdom, because she all, you know, and she was one of the persons, too, who was instrumental in laying the civil rights trail. When they did, she actually did that. She's an archivist. That's what she is. She's not only, number one, a communicator. Her degree was in communications, but she's also an archivist for Trinum University. And that's what she does now. You know, she's, you know, does archiving for the university. That's how. So she said, Gracie, as soon as you get to Louisville, don't forget to look up Ann Brayton so that you will be able to continue your activism. You know, because during the time that we were there during this whole period, see, we didn't stop just with the Angela Davis case. Once that case was set up, they got involved with the Joanne Little case, the Wilmington 10 case with Dr. Ben Chavis and the Wilmington 10. And it just went on to dealing with all type of freedom movements there, of the movement to free Nelson and Mandela. We got involved, intimately involved in that. And we was always dealing with the three evils that Ann was, and that was dealing with racism, war, and poverty. Those were our three big issues that we were concerned about, not only in terms of the national scene, but on the international level. So we was all pretty much, and most of the people who were involved in this movement were top-heavy people. They didn't just go to the universities and just study. I mean, because even when I first went there, Howard University used to be the hotbed. I mean, that was like where all of your, you know, people like Stokely Carmichael, all of the heavies that was in the movement, they would come there, like on the Saturdays, they'd have workshops, open workshops, for people to come in, and we just took on this movement with a fervor. Mm-hmm. So we continued on. So when I came back, I didn't stop in the movement. I just basically felt that I was called to serve. You know, all of us, including yourself, we have a mission to. All of us have a mission to continue the movement going, because we're always going to have a struggle. And we have to constantly train one generation to the next generation, because like right now, all the young people, they're going to inherit all of this debt that's going on. They should be intimately involved with it. So when I came back here, I think, I can't remember now what the hot button issue was here, but I know with Ann, I just continued to grow. But, you know, just being walking with Ann, you know, I would say my walk with Ann Brayton, because she really had she was just a one-woman powerhouse, and she was a great encourager of the people in the movement to just keep on moving. We would never, ever allow what's going on with Judy Greene, for example. Now, a lot of people right now have been very silent. If Ann Brayton was here, oh, she'd be all over that issue. She'd be and brought in Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, all of the top heavy peoples, because we are being disenfranchised in District 1. See, she would have gotten right on top of that. And one of the key issues here at the Alliance when I got involved, when I came back, was dealing with this issue of police brutality. It was around the issue of affirmative action, what was going on in the schools, like with the, you know, with the achievement gaps and all of that. But we had our plates full. I mean, the movement never really stopped. And the Alliance was right front center in everything. And with Jesse, they worked very closely with Reverend Jesse Jackson. In fact, the local Rainbow Push, Kentucky Rainbow Push Coalition, was in the Black Caucus offices. That's where they rented that space out to have the local Rainbow Push Coalition. And so as we did everything that we did, one of the things that Ann would always like to do is that she was fighting, and we had this critical resistance movement, was that we engaged a lot in research. Every activity that we got involved in, Dr. King said that you should never step out front to deal with any issues until you've adequately educated people as to why they were taking a stand. So that's basically one of the things that Ann did all the time. If you were to come in here, she'd have a cigarette in her hand, and also, number one, surrounded with all kind of research background materials. And so since I am, and I feel like I'm the same way, because whatever issue that I decide I'm going to get involved with in, I would have adequately researched it. I would have taken out time, and nobody, and most of the people in the movement, which is totally different now, totally absent now, they were dedicated and committed people. Nobody paid them anything. They was just believed in the cause that they were in, and they worked night and day. It was like we spent more time in the movement than we would on a regular job. So with me, I could go probably on any job, number one, and I would be, like I said, my field of study was urban studies, social welfare. So it was very easy to know what kind of issues I wanted to get involved in. I recall, like in one of my school classes, that I had wrote a paper on a bill for transportation facilities for the blind and handicapped. And I envisioned transportation. And today, don't you know right now that they have that TARP 3 paratransit system here that's up and running around the country? Now, what you see here, when you see those little vans that's running around, I actually envisioned that. And that was when I was a student in school. I had a copy of the bill. I had did a bill for one of my urban studies classes. I actually wrote the bill calling for this, and I could have went to Congress and presented this idea. But, you know, it's every time when I think about that bill and see these vans rolling around here. I mean, I actually envisioned that over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now I see it in fruition.
Right.
You know, so that's how important it is for students, young people, to get involved. Now, I personally would like to see more young people get hands-on, like on the issues now that are relevant now. They pick up the newspaper, they read, they develop, write papers and do research and get involved. Mm-hmm. And get involved. So that's what, that's my story. And then I have a sheet of something here I want to talk about, was that when Ann Braden, like in 1998, one of the things that we did was we started to build an action plan to implement affirmative action in Louisville. So we set up, we had called in people from the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights. I was the coordinator of the workshop. We had Cedric Powers. He was he spoke on affirmative action as a tool. Cedric Powers is associate professor of the law school at the University of Louisville, and we also had John Cumberland, who was the professor of history at U of L. And we also brought in, we had workshops on education, employment training, contracts, labor, housing, lending institution, and legislative and political action. Now, all of these issues here was pertaining to how do blacks get their piece of the pie. You know, how do we begin to struggle for equality? And Anne was very big on racism, and always fighting against injustices in terms of all of these areas, in the areas of education, employment, contracts, and she really did want us to get a piece of the pie. And so we were working people that actually worked to get these contracts. When we always tried to be at the table when the budget was being done. We'd be at the Board of Aldermen. I mean, it was no doubt about it. Now, when you go down to the budget hearings, you rarely see nothing but a few people who are in there impacting that system. And I know for myself, I've been one of the persons that have stayed right on it because I was taught that way, particularly by Ann Brayton, because she was always out there impacting the system, wanting us to be a part of whatever was happening. And then there was a major case. There was a major case in here that involved the shooting of this black man who was handcuffed, mm-hmm. And that was James Taylor. That was another big issue that Ann Brayton and all of us got ourselves involved in.
Was his shooting what started Kappa, or was that?
Yeah, I would say that what really started Kappa was the Adrian Reynolds case,
right?
Because Adrian Reynolds was probably about the first guy that I recall of our group getting involved in. And then by the time Kappa got started, we had already had Kappa. Kappa was already set up by the time James Taylor had been killed. Because by this time, there probably was 6 or 7 young men that had been killed by this time. And all of these police was able to go free. They never spent a day in. So that was one of the reasons why we decided to set up Kappa. And also, too, we ended up having a movement, of course, around that issue. And so we even brought in people nationally, like Joe Madison with the Associated Press. Dick Gregory came down, and we would, Dick Gregory came here, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton. We always, you know, that was the way, and Ann was really good about bringing in all of them. I mean, it was no big issue on it. Because we knew that a lot of our struggles was related to the broader struggles of what, because there was police brutality all across the country then. And in fact, in terms of the Congressional Black Caucus, that was one of the key issues that they would come out, and they actually had resolutions around police brutality. They even had hearings on police brutality around the country. And so James Taylor, of course, you know, that was a way of us also jumping out there and getting involved in it. So they started the citizens against police brutality, and that was bringing together a coalition of community groups, and they consisted of religious organizations and individual members that was working together to build a safer, healthier community through reform of police, prisons, and the criminal justice system. And we fought for setting up a police, really a civilian police review board that had subpoena power, you know, because it was just getting out of hand. And so on May 19, 2000, Mayor David Armstrong vetoed the police review board ordinance, which was passed May 9th. Now, because May 9th, the Louisville Board of Aldermen had basically, you know, they passed it. They passed the civilian review board ordinance. But Mayor Armstrong challenged it. He was saying that the ordinance violated state law by giving the review board subpoena power. That was his major problem, He didn't want to have that happen. And he said the audience undermines the mayor's authority over police officers. If the civilians can call it, then, you know, that takes away from the authority of the mayor or either the police chief to do anything. But we felt like that, you know, that the police is not, how can you really, can you investigate your own house? So they needed to be, now they did eventually set up a board, but this board was appointed by the mayor, and really they basically were not really buck up against the mayor. They pretty much went on and did everything the mayor asked them to do out of police chief. But we didn't stop then. We kept the drive going on, and we got petitions out there signed. We had postcards developed and everything to sort of get people to sign off and still impact the system. So right now we still don't. We got a police review board, but it's basically at the mayor's discretion and the police discretion. It still haven't been. We were unable to successfully move that to the point where there was a vegan review. Mm-hmm. So, and that was one of the issues that Ann really fought for until the day she died. There was no doubt about it. She never really seen that to become a full realization of that. And so that was another point that I enjoyed about her. Also, she was a very good organizer in terms of the issue of police brutality. And we got involved with the Mumia Abu-Jamal case, and we demanded a new trial because of all of the, that he's been on death row. Oh, wow. It's back then it probably was like 27 years, and, you know, he's still there. And that's just a sad situation because he was a journalist who was very intelligent. And right now, I don't know if they was ever yet. I know his case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, but I don't know really where it stands now. But she organized a busload, and we all went up to New Jersey, mm-hmm. and we joined in with the other protesters around the country, demanding a new trial, a new judge, and we also talked about the false witnesses. And then the true witnesses, which were never called, and then the confession, we had really mounted a major struggle around Mumia Abu-Jamal, and I think even today we should really continue to stay on it because, you know, this man has been sincerely, he really ought to be compensated for the time that he stayed. He should be released. Because they were never able really to, only thing that they actually found him doing was actually standing over the body. Not that he had a gun in his hand or nothing like that. But, you know, if you saw somebody laying on the ground that was bleeding, I probably would have gotten maybe caught up in a situation like that. Because I most certainly would be trying to see what happened, if the person was dead, alive, or what. But they were never, ever able to say, well, this gun came from him. Because it wasn't. He was just leaning over the body. And so all of this time, he's been incarcerated. And so that's where we are with that.
Well, and I know that I want you to talk a little bit about your work, the journalism work that you've done for the Alliance and that you do. I mean, I know with all of the issues you've been involved with researching and writing and speaking at press conferences, but will you talk a little bit about your work as a journalist?
Well, my work as a journalist is really being able to search for the truth. In the situation, I really do believe that we need to have more activists who really will do the research on issues, because without that type of background searching and keeping people aware on the real issues about an issue, whatever the issue may be, if it's in education, if it's in employment, or if it's on the current budget, the Social Security thing. Because I got a definite solution. Right now I would like to write an article on this issue about the debt ceiling and about them really trying to cut back Social Security, all of the entitlement programs for which senior citizens, including myself, number one, we worked. So I don't intend to not get my check. And right now I would like to organize a million senior march. Against Washington, because they are, you know, just going too far with this issue of Social Security. Now, they can, the current beneficiaries, we want our money. So as far as I'm concerned, we need to march on Washington about now. So as a journalist, I would do the research. You know, I talk really about, in fact, I've already have put a call in to Congressman John Yarmouth's office because I want him to send me some background information on the debt ceiling so that I can get a better understanding of this whole issue, so that I can break it down really to and write it in an article where our public will be educated. Because right now, this is a very, very critical situation. And as an activist, we need right now to have a call to action, because this is affecting everybody in this country. I mean, right, because there will have to be some type of calls to Washington, emails, texting, and whatever. Because if we don't get this situation resolved by August, I mean, we're going to be in a serious situation. When it comes down to the issues of war, right now we're spending around $9 million a day on our involvement in Libya. So as a journalist, I want people to be able to work. I want them to know right then and there. Well, that's one of the reasons why we're having debt problems, because we cannot police this world and have 10% unemployment in this country. So as a journalist, I need to look at the big picture. So I'm always seeking to look at the big picture. And that's the reason why I try to reach a broader audience. When I do my articles, sometimes I write for Forsooth, the Louisville Defender, the Carrier Journal, because these are the most of the newspapers that people do read. That's really what has caused me to be basically instrumental in writing, is because I wake up in the middle of the night and if it's a burning issue, I would jump right on it. And this issue with this new, I just heard before I came over here to do this interview, the president talking about what he's willing to do to either lift the ceiling on it or to be able to do the cutbacks. But he doesn't want the Social Security, Medicare, or those type of programs touched. He don't feel that the budget needs to be balanced off the least of us. And so as a writer, I would want to be able to convey that. But in order for me to do to get people to realize it, I need for them to get a better understanding of what that debt ceiling means. Because it's critical. It's a very critical issue. Because right now, that would mean devaluing the dollar on the international level. And if we're sitting back here literally sleep, and China has, and you know, look at China, all the debt that they have undertaken. We will be owned by China. So as a journalist and as a civil rights activist, we have to be able to tell the story and keep our eyes and ears attuned to what's happening in and around us. And that's what Ann did all the time. Ann was always writing letters to the editor. Every day when she got up and she would have a newspaper, she would go through that newspaper and pull out the issues, and she would write and respond on her own. Carrier Journal knew her. So when she'd call up, pick up the telephone, right then and there, she could automatically get a person, and all they have to do, she's telling them, I've got a story coming, I'm going to fax it over to you, and it would be in the paper. And that's what I do now. When I get ready, if it's a burning issue, I have a person over there who sort of pretty much gets my articles published. But on some controversial issues, I have not been able to get it out there. Mm-hmm. So that sort of disturbs me. And then I'll go to the secondary papers. Like, of course, I know Forsooth and like those other kind of papers, they pretty much would publish it. But sometimes on controversial issues, they don't want to put the opposing side story out there, mm-hmm. like this issue concerning Judy Greene. I am very much intimately involved in that movement, and because I feel like she's been railroaded out of this job. And if Ann Brayton was alive, she'd be right on top of this.
One of the things about the Alliance I've been talking to people about is just the uniqueness of it always being a multiracial organization, mm-hmm. of people of all backgrounds working together. And, I mean, is that something that has been important to you in your activism?
Oh, yes, it is, because it's the Alliance has always reached out to people, we have a good understanding of different cultures. And different, wanting to reach out to the broader community. And we are just, we don't live in isolation from other countries. We are so interlinked to the world scale that, you know, we've always been global minded, I would sort of say. So therefore, when you're dealing with issues of Hispanics, Nelson Mandela, we in South Africa, we always just got right on top of it. When the Ku Klux Klan came here, the Ku Klux Klan was going to come here one year, and we said, no, not in this town. And so we jumped out there, and we fought against the Klan, and we basically ran him out of town. I mean, you know, now the ACLU came out with an opposing view. They just felt like they had the right to march, and we felt like they had the right not to march. And so we had two different camps, the Ku Klux Klan on one side of the street, and we were on the other side. But we immediately had a call to action, and we jumped out there and we dealt with it. And so when it comes down to issues, we have never been afraid to stand on the trying to bring cultures together. I mean, even if it's in terms of a cultural festival, and we used to have a lot of activities dealing with concerts, and we used to use the Broadway Methodist Church down here, and we would have different groups, different cultures come in, and they would do singing songs of freedom and all of that. And we got involved with sometime, I think it was with the tomato pickles way down in Florida when they came here. And the Hispanic groups, they came here and they spoke about, you know, what they wanted to see in terms of raises. And we immediately jumped on it and brought together our coalition of people. Kentucky Alliance was bringing up. We brought together all of our groups and we have marched with them. Well, they marched on, I think it was the Yum Brand Center mm-hmm. at that time. They marched on them. So
these are the locally uh-huh. workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they got local workers. So that's basically what we've done. And also, too, one of the things we've been very instrumental in doing is trying to work for felons to get their voting rights back. Mm-hmm. And so one of the guys here, and he was, this is an article that was written up by U of L. It was a U of L person, Kelvin Rayburn, that did this article here. He was with the Kent School of Social Work. And it was in 1981 that Alan Barnett, he was an ex-con who had did 15 years in jail, in prison. And he came to the Alliance and sort of spearheaded our prison critical resistance movement in the prisons. And so Ann embraced him. She helped raise money so that he could go in and out of the prison systems. And so we even got a van at one point that would take us to the prison so that we could go in and just let them know that they have support out here. And regarding the health care, because, you know, health care is a big issue in there, because you can end up with AIDS and everything in prisons. And then it's just basically safety problems that go on. And so we want to assure that prisoners still have their rights even behind bars. And Alan Barnett, he passed about 2 years ago. He was instrumental in doing that. He got us intimately involved in that. And also Angela Davis has, as you know, she has never ever stopped organizing around the prison industrial complex. And she has this group called the Critical Resistance Movement here. So she still goes around the country and talks about prisons and the prison issue. She keeps that focus. She keeps focus on that. And it was interesting because a couple of months ago, I was sitting there and I was watching, had TV on. I think it was on either C-SPAN, and all of a sudden I looked up and it was Angela Davis, and she was still talking about the need for critical resistance. She was talking about the prison industrial complex, how we should never ever forget, because there is so much money that is spent behind bars, and how it was necessarily essential for us to break down that school to prison pipeline and to stop building more jails and prisons. And she was still very much intimately involved with the prison movement, even at her age. And you know, she's up there now. Mm-hmm. And But the issue of racism and just bringing together all groups of all cultures and background, that's just been, I mean, it's just natural. I mean, we just a rainbow group. Mm-hmm. We just a rainbow group. And so we're loving it, you know, because you can't do nothing. All of our movements is just interrelated. You know, we're interlinked no matter how we look at it. We're just all in this one great garment of destiny. So we just have to look beyond a person's color, race, sexual orientation, and just move on and just deal with the issues. The issues are far outweigh the color of a person's skin. And also, too, and I mean, in closing, particularly Ann Braden and Reverend Lewis Coleman, they got us intimately involved in racial profiling. Because that was an issue, driving while black and driving while brown. And just recently, we had met with, I met with this one group here, this one local group, and they are still dealing with this issue. They had to bring in the Justice Department in Atlanta to deal with this issue here because of this heightened fear of Muslims and people who look like Muslims. But just how they have been consistently stopped. And then we met just recently, I would say about 2 months ago, on that issue of racial profiling. It is still a big issue. But now it's a greater issue amongst just regular Hispanic people. Mm-hmm. And if Ann was alive, she would be really working with the groups now, because it is a major issue right here in Louisville. Where the people who are driving while brown is being consistently stopped. And in the West Louisville, it's the issue, again, driving while black. And a lot of the, right now, the mayor's budget was 56% allocated to the police. And they're still, every time you turn around, they're pulling over cars. Now, Anne, when she was alive and she saw a car pulled over, she would go right out there on that porch, take her pad and pencil. She would go walk over there to see why this person was being stopped. That's what I call number one, being how alert she was. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't believe that she would actually walk over there to that police car and actually, you know, ask them, you know, why is this person being stopped? But we also had a movement against racial profiling.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I'm very excited to have the opportunity to learn more about you. Okay. You've obviously been very involved in the news and writing so much, yeah. But I'm glad for the chance to learn more about your background. Thank you.
All right.